Hey, welcome to Variations on a Theme Film Podcast, where each episode we have in-depth discussions on two different films, highlighting a common theme between them. I'm your host, Jonathan Dyson, with my co-hosts...
Joseph Coyett.
Hi, Felicia Michie.
Spoilers are not avoided on this podcast, so we recommend you be familiar with the films we are discussing. So, today, we're discussing... two films from 1941, both happened to be in the running for Best Picture, among other awards at the Academy Awards of 1941. And those films are Citizen Kane by Orson Welles and How Green Was My Valley by John Ford. Felicia, you picked this theme, and we'll give you an opportunity to talk about why you chose these two movies before we actually discuss them. But before you tell us that, we're going to talk about what we've been watching recently, as we are wont to do on this podcast. So, who shall we start off with? Joseph?
Sure. So, I was at Under the Skin yesterday by Jonathan Glazer. Very good. It comes so hyped up, really, by a lot of critics that I went into it almost expecting to be disappointed, but it actually does, for the most part, live up to a lot of the hype that it's been receiving. Like, I was very impressed by it.
Did you see Sexy Beast?
Yeah, a long time ago when it came out, and I don't remember being, like, blown away by it. Just, like, I don't remember disliking it. I don't really remember having a strong response to it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen Birth, his other one, that came out, like, 10 years ago already, I think.
Nicole Kidman?
Yeah, that one. So I went into this pretty much no real preconceptions of what Jonathan Glazer can do or can't do. But it's such a strange film. Like, just the premise sounds like a terrible, cheesy sci-fi film. You know, like, what was that one in the 90s, Species or whatever, with, like, the supermodel alien, like, seducing men and killing them, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's a similar kind of thing, but... It takes it in such a strange way, and it never explains anything. You know, the whole film, you have no idea what's going on, really. It seems like Scarlett Johansson, the alien in question, is harvesting these people, usually lonely hitchhikers with no family or whatever. She picks them up, and she leads them into her lair, where they get sucked into some kind of goop, where they float, and eventually their insides dissolve, and they're left with only, like, skin floating around in the goop.
Hmm.
It's really unsettling imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But it just takes in so many strange ways. Like, those scenes in the lair are so, like, stylized and pristine and eerie, but then other stuff is, like, almost like documentary, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
Scenes on the street have this really natural... there's scenes in, like, a shopping mall, and they feel just like you're watching a documentary about a shopping mall, like, just
wow.
Flat and, you know, casual framing, flat lighting, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her conversations with the men when she picks them up, it, you know, just banal, mundane chit chat, like, no real purpose or anything, just, like, inane chatter, really. And they're filmed, you know, like that Kiarostami film where he has them in the car, you know.
Ten?
Yeah, that one. Yeah,
yeah.
It's filmed like that in a way.
Wow.
Like, it's, you know, it just takes in so many strange ways, because you have, like, this really stylized portion, and then you have this really, like, documentary mundane portion, and it just makes it so, I don't know, mesmerizing and,
mm-hmm.
and fascinating. You're just, like, sucked into it, even though you have no idea what anything is.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have said that a lot of people don't know what to make about the film. Some people are polarized. I mean, it tends to be a polarizing film from what I've read of the reactions to it.
Is there, like, a political, or I don't really know anything about this movie except for I saw Sexy Beast. I've seen it a couple times because I really love that movie. I think it's really fun. It's also just a really lovely love story, which is an odd thing to say about that movie because there's so much violence and awfulness from the Ben Kingsley character. Is that his name? Ben Kingsley?
Yeah.
But I'm listening to you explain it, and I'm wondering, I'd have to see it for myself, but I'm wondering, like, what is the, like, existential or political or sociological kind of, like, comment here? And I'm thinking, is this is this like an analysis of the like irrelevance of men or like men and identity in like today's society? And is there any of that happening? Because it sounds almost like
I've grappled greatly with what it actually means. I haven't read the novel that it's based on, but it sounds like from what I've read, the novel has more clear-cut, like, satirical, political kind of ideas that it's playing with. Whereas the film, everything is so opaque that it's hard to really give it a political dimension.
Is it, like, in a way an exploration of, like, I don't know, the modern man's, like, deep-seated fears just...
Well, isn't everything. There is something of that. Like, you could say, oh, it's about what it means to be human or something, which seems like such a bland cliche thing to say. I'm sure that's what everyone says about it because they don't know what else to say about it. But yeah, it's about what it means to be human. Because mm-hmm. what the hell else could it be about? I don't know. There might be like a kind of gender comment going on in there in a really oblique way, because like in the first half of the film, Scarlett Johansson's character, I don't believe it's named. I've read somewhere it was called Laura. I don't know if that's actually what her character's name is. It's irrelevant because she's just a cool like killing machine basically. Like the first half, she's like luring the men into her lair, and they're usually like just kind of, 20-something dudes, out for a good time. They get sucked in by Scarlett Johansson as a 20-something dude would. And then things start to change midway where she picks up a deformed guy, like a horribly deformed guy. And that's where it really started to get interesting and strange, because at first it seems like a almost cheesy, obvious thing to do, like to have her pick up this deformed guy all of a sudden. But it's so unsettling because she doesn't really recognize his deformity. She doesn't acknowledge it. Like, he's shopping at night because he's like an elephant man kind of face. And she doesn't acknowledge it at all. She just like talks to him normally. And it's so disturbing because it's hard to tell if that's like an act of kindness or if it's total indifference. And it can be read as both. Like, it's total indifference to what he looks like, but to him it feels like an act of kindness. Like, that's where it starts to get disturbing. And after like she consumes, or like she doesn't consume him, he goes into the goop as they all do. Although I think he survives. I don't know what's going on there.
And if it was like an act of like grace,
yeah.
Or
yeah,
if it's even like more cruel. It sounds like maybe that's the point of the movie when, as a viewer, that's when, like, the manipulation kind of... Like, the filmmaker's really trying to get you to... like, you're not sure how you feel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's a very...
It's very predictable with, like, all the, like, the younger, like, kind of whatever jockey guys or whatever
yeah.
they were. And
yeah, and here you start to feel more uncomfortable about her position. And she does, too, as well, it seems. She begins to kind of reflect on what she's doing, I think. It's hard to tell because it's such an opaque performance. It's a very good performance, I should note, like from Scarlett Johansson, because she's so like flat and robotic, and yet you get like these kind of inflections in it. So yeah, she's quite good in it. But from there, like she kind of runs away from her job. She eventually gets like picked up by a guy. She's the one who's picked up now, and this guy seems to fall for her, and he's like caring for her. And eventually they have sex, and it freaks her out so much that she runs away from that. And then eventually she almost gets raped, and the rapist freaks out because he sees what she is, like this alien creature, and he sets her on fire and she dies. The end.
What?
I know. So
that's probably why people are so... Because I was going to say what I forgot... that I was going to say was a lot of people seem to be vaguely like they seem to be impressed with the movie, but they're not necessarily satisfied by
yeah.
it. It sounds like a deliberately confounding movie.
It is very deliberately confounding. Yeah.
Were you satisfied by it? Does it matter actually?
I enjoyed it immensely. Like I was mesmerized by it. Like I was drawn in, and partly that's a result of its like mysteriousness, its confusingness. Because if you explain this stuff, if you like elaborate the whole thing going on behind it, it would probably sound like the most ridiculous, stupid movie possible. Like, it would, you know, alien is harvesting men, and then someone loves her, and she has doubts about her job, yeah, and then she dies. Like, there's not a lot there, but, like, the second half of the film, it's like she's put in the position where she, where the men were at the beginning, and she becomes the vulnerable one, and I don't know, there's a lot of different ways you can approach that, and I don't know
sounds
which
like,
way to approach
sounds
it.
Sounds like there's a lot of room for...
Yeah.
To me, sounds like there's a lot of room for a gendered analysis,
yeah,
there. Is it presented in the way that she kind of gets what she had coming to her? Like, the rape is somehow a revenge that the viewer can feel good about because she...
No, I don't think so. I felt very horrified by the end. Like, what... I think you are supposed to ultimately empathize with her more than anyone else in the film. And her death is very painful, I thought. Like, just the image of it. I mean, the creature that she is like this kind of black-skinned humanoid thing. And the rapist, like, when he attacks her, he, like, tears her skin. And that's when he freaks out and realizes that she's not a normal human. And he runs away and he gets gasoline and sets her on fire. But she's, like, left there, like, peeling away her skin. And she's, like, staring at her face. And her face is, like, weeping in her hand. Like, you're not supposed to be thinking, like, oh, that she got what she deserved in that scene. You're,
mm-hmm,
supposed to feel, like, just horror, abject horror at this is what happened to her. But, yeah, like, I don't know. It's such a tough film to tie any, like, to pin any sort of meaning on. But it's fascinating. Like, it's... any mysterious film like that, it's fun to push against and to explore, like, the different interpretations, and yeah, like, it's just a fascinating, strange film, because he, I don't know, it's so many weird mixtures of tone and style, and yeah, I liked it, it's great, yeah.
Yeah, I wish we could have seen it so we could talk about it with you, nonetheless, I'm still very curious. We're gonna have to check it out for ourselves eventually.
Yeah, it's well worth it, yeah.
Okay, well, shall we move to you, Felicia?
I haven't watched very many movies other than the movies we're going to talk about today, but we all went together to see La Jolie Mai by Chris Marker at the cinema a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, it was a lovely sort of documentary, I guess. Obviously, is not the typical talking head style documentary, but the just showing... Sorry, I actually can't remember the movie. Hold on.
It's got the social housing, the people moving to the new house. You've got the suit salesman at the beginning. You've got...
Cats in Funny Hats.
Cats in Funny Hats.
So the premise is, like, May. It's, like, the month of May in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
In 19...
1961, I believe, following the end of the Algerian War. So it's supposed to capture some sort of zeitgeist in Paris at the time, I guess. I immensely loved that film. But like you, Felicia, I already kind of... its presence in my mind is rather fleeting and nebulous. And not because it's a bad movie. I love the movie. But in the same way that his other movies, Saint Soleil and Le Jeté, like, I barely remember them. I remember loving them. I remember how amazed I was at them, but I barely remember them.
Because it's subtle. It's subtle and light, and there's nothing, like, stark, bold, or, you know, nothing really jumps out at you. It's just sort of, like, 2 hours of this, you just get sucked into very... like watching very simple scenes of people going about their life and talking about their, you know, very common troubles, whether it's just like making enough money to pay the rent or finding, you know, suitable housing for families, and sort of going from one conversation to the next, and you kind of feel a part of that world and you feel part of that culture and society or family, or sort of feel like you just really get, sucked in, I guess, but then it kind of just spits you right back out,
mm-hmm,
at the end, and
yeah.
And it is I guess a little bit hard to, but it's also, I think, there's a really lovely poetry and rhythm,
yeah,
to the film. The shots are, it's just very natural and a really nice flow, going from one scene or one shot to another. Musical cues and use of music is really lovely. There's that one piano piece, I can't remember the name of it. I looked it up after, but it's really lovely, and they have that throughout the film as well. And
the narration, I think, is also crucial to kind of linking all the various subsets of Parisian life together and tying them together.
I'm remembering now the sort of the thing that most jumps out most about the film is Chris Marker's desperation in trying to, like, he's having all these conversations with people, and the interviewers are asking, really trying to pull out of people, like, their sense of community or their sense of the world or their position on, like, the Algerian War, their position on just, like, things, like, the state of society, and he, like, everybody is so nonplussed, and so maybe that's a quintessential, I don't know, it's, like, French-Parisian thing at the time. Everyone's just more concerned with paying bills or getting married or having a nice summer, and no one has very many thoughts as to, community or society or politics. Everyone's really disengaged.
Yeah, on the big issues, everyone seems to be ambivalent, I would say. Like, they're good-natured, but ambivalent. And not necessarily, like, not that they don't care. They just seem, like, almost, disinterested.
You have, like, that huge political funeral, like, that sequence.
That was amazing.
Yeah, it's a very powerful sequence. It felt like the whole city ground to a stop when you're watching that sequence. But then when he starts talking to people, you know, it's like that's a whole world that they weren't even aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not aware of what was going on there with, you know, their fellow Parisians, like, probably 10 blocks over. And, it's tough to, like you guys, you know, it's hard to hold that film in your head. Because Marker is not really one to, like, pound you over the head with a thesis or a statement. He's so open-ended, and just, he's so innately curious that even if he went into that film with a statement in mind, like, his natural curiosity and just fascination with people kind of blows open whatever thesis he could make and just creates such an open-ended, beautiful film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is considered, could it be classified as an essay film? Because Sensel is definitely an essay film.
Yeah. I would say it's an essay film.
Not that there is only, like, one kind of essay film, but okay. Well, yeah, so we all saw that at the theater, and that was a great time. I'm really glad we went to see that. And is there anything else you want to talk about, Felicia?
No, that's the only movie I've seen lately.
Okay. Well, then I'll just mention briefly a couple films I saw. First one is James Benning's 13 Lakes. I'm guessing neither of you have seen this?
No. No, I haven't seen any Benning, but I feel like I should, because he is such a huge movie.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if 13 Lakes is a good place to start. I know some of his older films are more, like, straightforward, like Landscape Suicide is kind of a famous documentary he made in, I believe, the 70s. I haven't seen that. And this is the only Benning film I've seen other than the companion piece to this film, 10 Skies. So 10 Skies and 13 Lakes, he released them both in 2004 to great acclaim, at least from the highbrow cinephile circles. And in short, 13 Lakes is, I'd say, static shots of 13 Great Lakes. What is a Great Lake? Maybe not Great Lakes, but I think it's Great Lakes. But aren't there only a few Great Lakes, like, around Ontario?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not Great Lakes. Okay, so 13...
Just really good lakes.
Yeah. Great with a lowercase great. Yeah, so 13 static shots of 13 various lakes in America. And most of them I was not familiar with. There were a couple... None of them I recognized, but... And surprisingly, there's a lot of variety to it. Like, one lake looks like it's in the Arctic, and it's windy, and there's ice, and another lake is near a port, and there's ships going in and out. Another lake, you know, there's, like, guys in sea-doos riding back and forth on the lake. Some lakes, it's clear skies. And this is structuralist filmmaking, so the structure is very specific. The bottom half of the screen is the lake, and the top half of the screen is the sky or the horizon or the land or whatever, right? There's a couple of lakes in the mountainside, and most of them are just beautiful to look at. And each shot is 10 minutes long. So that makes it 130 minutes long, and that's the film. And 10 skies, the companion piece, is the same, except 10 shots, 10 different skies, just the clouds and whatever. And I saw that a while back. And yeah, this is really like extreme, austere filmmaking. It's not for everyone. I mean, as you can tell from my description, but I really enjoyed it. It's really meditative and soothing, and surprisingly, like I said, there's a lot of variety. Like, you just sink into this one scene, this one lake, and then 10 minutes later, it abruptly cuts to a new lake, and you've like spent 10 minutes soaking in the scenery and how beautiful it is, and the environment, and then you abruptly shift to a new lake, so it actually doesn't really get boring. It's really interesting, and I'd like to see more James Benning. And this is the kind of stuff he does. So he also has another movie called Railroad, which is like a bunch of trains that he films. So, and a lot of this sounds so obvious. It's like, well, why doesn't everyone do that? But he's really good at it. And he teaches film at SoCal, Southern California, Cal Arts or something, California School of the Arts. So James Benning is a highly respected figure, and he's no amateur. And only shitty thing is this film is a rip from, it was aired on German television, and so it's a rip of someone's like television set, so it's pretty poor quality, and with something like this, you want good quality. So I don't know why they can play it on television in Germany, but not give it a decent DVD release. It's bullshit. You know,
what kind of channel in Germany plays structuralist film? Wow.
Well, I call it avant-garde structuralist film, but actually we have cable, and there's this cable television channel where they just show like static shots of scenes in various cities and environments all around the world. It's called Armchair Tourist or something.
I thought you were going to talk about the log, Burning Log channel.
Well, it's kind of like that.
Which,
it's just like,
I guess, is an avant-garde film in its own way.
Yeah, this Armchair, truly. I mean, Warhol made films like that.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
So I don't know. So it's really not that radical, but it's just like, kind of just a patience duration test kind of thing, but I really enjoyed it. So that's the one thing I watched. Other thing I watched is Kenneth Anger's most famous film from 1964, Scorpio Rising. Have you seen it, Joseph?
No.
I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a few other Kenneth Anger short films.
This is what Jonathan gets up to on a Saturday morning before I'm out of bed, because it's the only time he can get in these more, he's more adventurous with his films. So if he wants to get in these, the more avant-garde experimental stuff, then it's Saturday mornings when I'm still in bed. Although this one, I'm exaggerating. There's a lot of movies that he watches that I've enjoyed, like the one, the New York filmmaker he documented.
Jonas Mekas.
Right. I saw a lot of those, and they were lovely. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Jonathan, go on with your...
I wish you had seen it, and I'm sure you will see it someday, because Scorpio Rising is not like a duration patience test, like 13 legs. It's 28 minutes long, I think. Oh. And it's just like a bravura filmmaking. It's just an orgy of blasphemy and sacrilegious imagery and shocking motifs. And
he's paying homage to Edmonton Gay Pride Day.
Inadvertently, yeah. It was, Kenneth Anger being one of the first out openly gay, filmmakers in Hollywood. And I don't know what his connection in Hollywood is, because he never was like, I don't know how Hollywood he is, but he wrote these Hollywood Babylon books, which are kind of legendary for disseminating rumors and gossip about all these famous Hollywood stars. So Kenneth Anger is a really idiosyncratic person, and his films are equally as idiosyncratic. And this one, you just like find it online, give it a watch. It's really stunning and shocking, and lots of taboo pushing. I mean, in short, it's like a neo-Nazi gay biker gang riding around with like would score to like 50s pop songs, 50s like, yeah, weird 50s pop songs that you may be familiar with, intercut with like scenes from this old silent biblical movie of Jesus with his disciples and curing people of leprosy and that sort of thing. Just like totally like pushing so many people's buttons. Of course, the film was banned too. They tried to censor it. And I think the Supreme Court case ruled in favor of Scorpio Rising, actually. But yeah, so it's really fascinating. And his other films I've seen are shorter, but very similar. I think I liked a couple others more than this one, but it's really remarkable. And Kenneth Anger occupies a unique, singular place in cinema, especially avant-garde cinema. He's really got a unique style of his own, and he's not just like a provocateur. I hate to use the word anger, but there is an anger or a rage and a passion that's surging through his movies that you can really feel, and it's really compelling. So that's the other thing I watch. And other than that, I haven't really watched anything. Been busy because it's pretty much summertime, but I think now we can dive into discussions of the two films that we're talking about today.
So we came to choose these two films. Well, it was my pick this time. I hadn't seen Citizen Kane, and it's like the movie of all movies in the world of cinephiles. So for that reason, I think I kind of put it off for a little while because I thought, well, it would just be too sort of, I don't know, too typical to like to watch that movie. So I thought maybe I'll never see that movie on purpose. And it's of course on so many people's, you know, their top tens, you know, people that I know, of course, but then also, you know, like famous writers and thinkers and directors, and everybody loves Citizen Kane. So so in thinking about what we were going to pair it with, it was because I hadn't seen it, so it was a really hard choice. And or I couldn't think of something, but then I don't even, one of you thought How Green Was My Valley, I think. I can't remember how we came to figure out that these two movies, I think Joseph, you knew that they were both in the running for Best Picture, among other things, among other awards at the 1941 Oscars, which is fascinating. And How Green Was My Valley won Best Picture.
Yeah.
Citizen Kane, I believe, won several other...
I think it just won Best Screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's... I don't know. It's hard to even know how to approach this. Like, I don't know what to say about Citizen Kane that hasn't been said a million times before. And...
Well, did you like it?
So, I really loved both films a lot. How Green Was My Valley? I don't know which movie we're going to talk about first. Usually we just...
Well, I don't know. Which one should we do?
I don't know. What's better to start with?
Let's keep talking about Citizen Kane and then...
Okay. So, I feel Citizen Kane, I liked it a lot, and it was 2 hours. 2 hours of, like, I didn't blink, I didn't breathe. I felt like when I did blink, I would, like, miss something, because it's very, very fast-paced. But in that pace, it's so amazingly, like, the editing and the how one scene, like, will flow into another, and of course... one of the things that this movie is known for that I've read a lot about and people talk about is the cinematic mastery that is the film. A lot of really interesting technical things happening that when I was watching this film, you know, I said within the first 5 minutes to Jonathan that it had an amazingly, like an impressively modern quality to it. As soon as the early scene when the, you know, he says Rosebud, drops the snow globe and you see the reflection of the nurse walking into the room to him, and you see her reflection in the snow globe on the floor, and I thought that was really cool. But of course 100 other things then follow that are just as cool throughout the film. So it was great. I think that you know, what I said to Jonathan after, is that where, how green was my valley, I think is a move, although there are interesting cinematic, like technical things happening in that film as well. But I think that How Green Was My Valley is maybe like the strength of that film is the story itself and the, you know, the sentimentality and the drama of the story and of it. It's very an epic story following a family over the course of several decades, 40 years or something. But whereas Citizen Kane, the story is good. It's an interesting story, you know, rise and fall of it's a that quintessential story of an American man, or it's an American story. But I feel like Citizen Kane is much more so. It's less about the story and more just the movie, the technical prowess, and of course Orson Welles is positively magnetic. So yeah, that's. I think that's pretty much all I have to say about Citizen Kane.
Hopefully that's not all.
Well,
we just started.
Yeah.
Were you aware that the original name on the script was American? Just because you said, you know, it's an American story, American man. Like, that was the original title.
Oh,
American.
Is that right?
I mean, what was the original title?
American.
American?
Yeah.
It'd be an odd, I'm glad they changed it. But
yeah, Citizen Kane is much better, definitely.
Yeah.
But that's what they worked under, yeah.
But yeah, no, it is. Yeah, it is a uniquely American story, whereas How Green Was My Valley is
Welsh.
Sorry. yeah, like you couldn't, like Europe would never make a film like Citizen Kane. It's quintessentially
America. Well, America, it's the story of America that makes this story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough to know what to say about Citizen Kane, but particularly because it's almost overwhelming on first view. Like, it's just, and it is such a fun film to watch. Like, as far as, you know, masterpieces go or great films go, you know, sometimes they can be a chore. This is just, like, it's fun to watch. It's so dynamic, so stylish. It's so show-offy. Like, Orson Welles is such a showman, and it comes across, like, you know, he's so good at presenting and driving you in.
And yet there's not one moment that seems nothing ever seems overdone or overacted or over, like, a camera shot or something that was too show-offy. Everything worked perfect. I think it's kind of a perfect movie when you look at, you know, performance and the technical ability and the use of music, and I think it's really tight.
Yeah.
When I you speak of the showmanship of Citizen Kane, and actually what some scenes reminded me of, actually, and I haven't seen Wolf of Wall Street, but just from seeing, like, scenes from Wolf of Wall Street and the trailer, I'm like, wow, why does this remind me of Wolf of Wall Street? But nonetheless, it did.
Well, they're similar, you know, like the man who,
yeah,
like,
well,
rises.
Yeah, well, I thought of that as well. Similar narrative arc as well, yeah.
And I believe Scorsese quotes, at the very least, the parrot scene from Citizen Kane. He quotes that in Wolf of Wall Street.
Just the parrot, like,
yeah, not the parrot
scene.
The parrot, you know, where you have it, like, squawking at the beginning of the
scene. Well, okay.
I don't remember the exact context in Wolf of Wall Street, but yeah, like, he's obviously
just
got
kind of
Citizen
Kane.
It's
an homage, but that makes me question, like, was there significance to that parrot being there, or was that just a stylistic flourish?
For Wells?
Yeah.
He just wanted to wake up the audience, make sure
they
were paying attention.
Well, it definitely did that.
Yeah, not that the audience would be asleep in this film. Like, of all the films that you need to wake up the audience in, this is not one of them. But nonetheless, that's what he always said was the reason behind that pair.
Yeah, and actually, even before the scene you talked about, Felicia, with the snow globe dropping or whatever at the beginning of the film, even the scenes preceding that with the shots of the outside of Xanadu, is this state called Xanadu?
Yeah.
The shots of Xanadu with the dark, like, foreboding music and the chain link fence and the big imposing K signifying Kane. Those shots alone, they were just like static shots, and those implied a kind of modernist technique to film that really was nowhere to be found in How Green Was My Valley. And it, I think, is very telling that the Academy is always behind the times. They're always quick to reward something that they find traditionally appealing, and they weren't ready. No one was ready for Citizen Kane, something as artistically kind of revolutionary as Citizen Kane. The Academy wasn't ready for it, and it's, you know, so that makes it abundantly clear why it didn't win Best Picture, which it probably should have. But I mean, and we'll talk about How Green Was My Valley later, but I can see why that did win Best Picture, because it's much more of a tearjerker. It plays with emotions more. But I do think it was deserved that Citizen Kane won Best Screenplay, because the screenplay is top-notch as well. The writing is just, it's airtight. And it's written by that...
Herman Mankiewicz?
Herman Mankiewicz.
Older brother of Joseph.
Yeah, who did All About Eve, which we watched recently. And I love the script. I love everything about it. But it's, you know, I was comparing it to my, you know, my two favorite films are The New World by Malick and Stalker by Tarkovsky. And I was actually kind of thinking, like, those two films have very little in common. In the same way, I love both Citizen Kane and How Green Was My Valley, which also have very little in common, in that The New World and How Green Was My Valley are films that really tug at my heartstrings and evoke an emotional response from me, whereas Citizen Kane and Stalker are films that, like, intellectually, I'm just in awe of of the mastery and of the prowess of the filmmaking, and they just leave me kind of stunned, but they're not like films of strong emotional content.
That's interesting, actually. I don't know if you watched on the How Green Was My Valley DVD, there's an interview with Peter Bogdanovich. And he actually, I mean, he being a great friend of Orson Welles, but also a huge admirer of Ford, he's comparing both films on the DVD, and he basically sums it up as saying, like, they're both equally great films in his view, but How Green Was My Valley really is for the heart, and Citizen Kane is really for the head. Like, that's how he has a similar divide.
See, guys, I'm onto something here. But no, How Green Was My Valley is such a romantic movie.
What do you mean
movie.
You're onto something? I said it first about 3 minutes ago.
Okay. But Citizen Kane is another thing that marks its kind of modern approach to filmmaking, is it's so unromantic. Its portrayal of Citizen Kane and how it humanizes Kane, yet it doesn't sentimentalize or kind of canonize him, nor does it demonize him. It's just like totally has an, I'd say, unsentimental rendering of his character that I found to be really, probably uncommon in films back then.
Yeah.
He wasn't an anti-hero, though. I don't think he was an anti-hero, but he's just such a unique character to have as a protagonist of the film. Though I don't know, would he even constitute as a protagonist? Because the kind of almost like documentary approach to film, not documentary approach, but it's kind of the style of filmmaking, or the style of the plot, is like kind of like starts with his death, and then it's actually from the perspective of this investigative reporter trying to find out the meaning of the Rosebud thing. So I don't even know if there is a protagonist.
Well, I mean,
not that it
there's
matters,
a subject.
But,
there's,
yeah, the subject.
That's maybe the way to look at it. He's the subject of the film. He's not necessarily the protagonist, but he's what is being explored nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And the reporter is really just, you know, like a conduit for the audience more than anything else. Like, he's a non-entity. You don't even really see his face. He's just there to be like a kind of camera within the film.
Yeah.
Something for us to view the story through, which is, again, like a very modern gesture. Like just to watch this film next to any other film from 1941 is a huge shock.
Have you seen any other films from 1941, just out of curiosity?
I was double checking the other ones nominated for Best Picture, and like there was Suspicion by Hitchcock and Maltese Falcon by Huston.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, those are good films. I like them. and I wouldn't like dream of trashing them or anything, but again, like compare them, just the look, the feel, like there's so much. And it's not just the look, really, it's the sound. Like, no film sounds like Citizen Kane. Even now, I don't know if any film sounds quite like Citizen Kane. Like, one of the people like to talk about the visuals of Citizen Kane, you know, the deep focus and all the great stuff that Greg Toland, the director of photography, did, which is really radical, and it is a gorgeous film, art direction, cinematography. But yeah, the sound, like Bernard Herrmann's score, is very striking and unique. And just how Wells handles dialogue. Like, he brought so much of his radio skills to the film that, like, it's almost more shocking just to hear the film than the visuals. Like, that's almost the more radical part of it. Like, just how the dialogue will be, like, spliced up between scenes, and he'll, like, string it together to, like, use it, you know, he'll, like, divide up dialogue to use as a transition, which is a very radio kind of thing, and the overlapping dialogue, and just all that kind of stuff. It's very unique.
I did take notice of it as well. I silently noticed the exceptionality of the sound editing and how it was all done. And I didn't know that you said Orson Welles had a background in radio or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that was a huge, you know, the War of the World broadcast that he's famous for.
Oh, okay.
Which is probably kind of one thing that sort of kickstarted his move into Hollywood, because it was such a famous event and well-known radio thing. But yeah, he was huge in theater and in radio. And I think you can find a lot of the radio plays online easily enough, like from the 30s and 40s. And they're certainly worth seeking out. I don't think I've listened to many. I did listen to War of the Worlds a long time ago, and it's interesting stuff. It's but yeah, he was also very inventive with theater as well, and he did some very like radical interpretations of Shakespeare in the 30s and stuff like that, and he brings all that expertise into the film, and that is maybe one of its main claims to greatness. Like, not the fact that he pushed forward like cinematography and camera style so much, because that was almost more a technical thing, and he was just managing to ride that like the crest of that wave, because Toland was already doing stuff like that with John Ford.
Oh.
And Wells just kind of pushed him further, I think.
So that cinematographer had worked with John Ford as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he,
but not on How Green Was My Garden.
No. He did The Long Voyage Home, and I believe also Grapes of Wrath. But yeah, Long Voyage Home, which I believe was 1940, is a very, it's worth watching and comparing to Citizen Kane. Just, you can see Toland getting closer to Citizen Kane and stuff. But yeah, like, one of the really great things is just how much Wells brings, like, his theater and radio background to film, which were things that weren't really integrated well into film at that point. And particularly, like, theater gets knocked as, like, you know, you don't want films to feel like a play.
Yeah.
And yet, Wells brought a lot of that theatrical thinking to how he stages, how he places the camera. Like, the scenes where he's got, you know, the camera at the feet of Kane.
I noticed that.
It's like an audience view in a theater, right?
Like, when his friend Leland comes into the office drunk after he loses the election.
Yeah. And so it's a very striking cinematic gesture, but it's also really, in a sense, recreating the feel of a stage play. You know, you're in the audience. There's a lot of stuff like that and just how the camera moves, it feels like it's another performer on the stage with these people. He has such a radical sense of space and movement, and I think that comes from the theater more than anything else. So,
which is funny though, because I mean, you wouldn't think that, because in theater you just have a fixed perspective from which to see the play. But I guess, but another shot that I mean there's so many amazing shots, but one shot that struck me was when that Greg, what was the name of the politician who was trying to blackmail
Jim Geddes,
when Jim Geddes was at Susan Kane, well, she was Susan Alexander at the time, when they all met at Susan Kane's, Susan Alexander's place, and Jim Gettys was trying to blackmail them. And then his first wife, Emily Kane, was walking towards the exit door and says, Charles, are you coming? And then just the way the camera frames everyone, you have Emily Kane at the one end, and then you have Charles Kane on the other end, and in between them is Susan and Jim. And just the way the line of the, what do you say, the line of sight, or the, I don't know, the,
that works,
the perspective of the camera very clearly, like, uses the placement of the characters to kind of comment on the conflict that's happening, the kind of psychological conflict that's happening in Charles' head while he tries to make that decision.
Yeah.
So
there was a couple other scenes where the camera is similarly, like the scene is similarly composed. At the beginning, when you have Kane as a child and he's outside playing in the snow, and then the
that
mom is on
sequence,
one side, and the dad kind of seems to pop in and out, and then on the other side is the man who becomes his guardian, and it's like that sort of moral, dialogue decision that's being made as to, you know, the fate of Kane as a child, and if what's about to happen is the right thing. And you can see him.
Yeah, he's always in the screen there too.
Yeah.
And I read that, I don't know a lot about film, like in a technical way, like about cinema, like how shots are filmed and different kinds of like camera film that's used, stuff like that. But what I did, I remember reading about the kind of scenes that we're talking about, is I think what this film did that maybe hadn't been done before was, in previous to this movie, when they did a shot like that, there wouldn't have been a way for things that are in the distance to be in focus while everything at the front was so things from far away would have been out of focus while things closer would have been in focus, or they had to do it vice versa.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't have been able to have everything in sharp focus at once. So
yeah,
I remember reading that before watching the film, so of course those things stood out to me. I noticed them when they happened.
Is that what deep focus is called?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And as I recall, Wells said in some interview that the thinking behind that was partly that's sort of how people see the world. They don't see, like, you know, something near them is always like in focus, something far away is always out of focus. Like, they switch. They their view changes, and so we wanted to create that sense of openness in the film too. And that opens up, the fact that you can do that then opens up so many other possibilities with the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Like that great sequence, you know, at the mother's boarding house. It's like really, you know, two minute shots for
mm-hmm.
almost, like
mm-hmm.
he can do so much just moving around with the camera because he can have so much stuff in focus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it just creates an entirely different feel than what you would get from a lot of other Hollywood films, which would, like, chop stuff up more, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They are very long shots, so you don't notice them at first, but occasionally I would be like, wow, this shot's gone on for quite a long time.
Yeah, for all the showiness that we talk about in the film, some of the shots, you don't even feel how long they're going, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you're so absorbed in them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie truly does nail everything. It gets everything just right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, of course, there's the political dimension of the movie, in that the screenplay was actually based on the life of William Randolph Hearst, and the subsequent censorship, or maybe even panning of the film by, in all of Hearst's newspapers. And the kind of zeitgeist it captures in this kind of age where, like, newspaper barons kind of ruled the world back then, you know, they were more influential than politicians in many ways. And, you know, that nowadays that age is coming to a very bitter, slow end.
I wonder what Conrad Black thinks about Citizen Kane. I'd love to ask
that. That would be great. Yeah.
Well, I think there's, like, been a book written about Conrad Black called, like, Citizen Black or something.
Oh, okay.
You know,
there you go.
Yeah.
Obviously a book that's very critical of Conrad Black.
Yeah.
I think people have come around with Conrad Black. I mean, he's become so... He's he's done such a, Conrad Black's done such a 180 where he realized how arrogant and pompous he was and how he kind of disavowed Canada, at least his, you know, in order to join the House of Lords in Britain. And now he comes crawling back to Canada, after he gets out of jail in America. And now he's, so people have come around with Conrad Black, and I think he deserves a bit of sympathy because he's just like all these narratives of the rise and fall of very powerful men. He's, you know, Conrad Black had his downfall, and now he's a much more humbled man. Though I don't know if Charles Kane really has a downfall. He just kind of grows older and becomes increasingly bitter and perhaps eccentric and reclusive, you know. But by the time he dies, I think he's all alone in this monster, in the Xanadu, which is this monstrous palace, like populated by all these sculptures and paintings and artifacts that he's collected over the years.
Yeah.
Almost as if, I think the point is to compensate for losing Rosebud, you know. Maybe he's trying to make up for that with all these other things that he think will I don't know, of course they're not going to restore the innocence that he lost when Rosebud was taken from him, but maybe he thinks that they'll fill that void in his life. And of course the rhetorical answer to that question is no, they don't. But he did recover Rosebud. Did he know he had Rosebud in his possession?
I don't think so. I think it was just lost in the maze of stuff, right? Like, and it is, like, Rosebud is, you know, in a sense, kind of silly as a device. And, like, Wells made fun of it. And
oh, did he?
Well, there's even the line in the, I think, the film kind of, like, you know, saying, you know, like, nothing could explain this man. Like, there's really, you know, it's like a disclaimer. Like, don't put too much stock in Rosebud, because nothing can explain him. And it...
There wasn't that at the end of the film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I think the reporter says
He does,
And really, ultimately, it's just, he has this hole in him, and he can't fill it. And even Rosebud, I don't think, can fill it.
Rosebud is just, is merely, I mean, I would think is... not, it's not the loss of Rosebud, like his sled.
Yeah.
It's the loss of, like, an innocence of childhood and being broken away from his family, and how that obviously haunted him, like, until he died.
But was it even a happy family home? Like, that family scene is so fascinating, and, like, just trying to read into the family dynamics in, like, a 4-minute sequence, but... It's like, was the father abusing him?
It was vague and almost, I mean, dare I say, insufficient to kind of form a coherent idea of what was going on.
Yeah, like I was reading, I think Michael Atkinson, that film critic, I was reading a little thing by him where he was speculating on the family in Citizen Kane, and I believe his explanation that he fell on was that the mother... had an affair with Fred Graves, the absent boarder that left them the sheriffs to the mine, but he left it only in her name.
And
Atkinson argued that Graves was the father of Kane, and that's why he left it only to the wife.
Oh, okay.
And that's why the wife sent her son away, because, you know, she didn't want him with this, like, false father who she hated. And so that's one, like, I don't necessarily buy into that, but it's a interesting interpretation, and it is semi-plausible, but like, you could also just read that the father was an abusive drunk or something, you know, like he almost does hit, like, for all his, like, kind of kindness and warmth towards his son, when Kane pushes over Thatcher, the banker, like, the father is just, like, ready to, like, wail on him. So there's, like, this brief flicker of anger, and then, you know, the mother pulls him aside, and she's like, you know, I'm sending him far away where you can't get him. And so it feels like there's a suggestion that there's some kind of, like, threat there, and yet Kane doesn't seem like he wants to leave it. Like, he doesn't seem threatened, so that makes it so hard to read, because
I think he's, maybe it's his mother that he doesn't want to leave, although she comes across, like, she's really austere and stern. But, you know, he kept asking, like, are you coming? Like, when he's told he's going to Chicago, he says, are you coming, mommy? Are you coming with? He asked her, like, three times if she's coming along. And I think it's because the theme, like, we hear the analysis of Cain from all the people that he knew throughout the film.
Yeah.
It's like the women are talking about Cain and the men that worked with him and his guardian and the sort of Cain's Achilles heel was that he did not feel loved. This was his motivation for wanting to go into politics and always seeking sort of love and adoration of people. And I think it was that obviously feeling that he wasn't loved enough to be kept in the home. Because if there was a dynamic there, of course he was a child and never understood it, why the mother would want to send him away.
Yeah. And I guess also that scene is being told from Thatcher's point of view, because that's like from his diary. So we're getting an outsider's view on this, right? Mm-hmm. Like essentially Thatcher is the one recalling this scene, not Cain. So we're not really getting Cain's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe that's why he imagines Cain being just like happy, you know, like he's just a kid. He's just off doing his own thing, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I don't know if the mother necessarily did not love Cain. Like, I think it's suggested that she does love him dearly, but she feels the need to send him away. And that's why she's so emotionally shut down at that point. Like, she's resigned. She's kind of broken at that point. And she's...
There may have been also an element of shame in...
Yeah.
I mean, if she had him as a result of an affair that... would have added another layer to...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was her... And again, I feel like the film didn't even make clear. What was her reasoning? Something to do with, okay, she inherited these shares from the mine, which was abandoned, but then all of a sudden it became valuable again, so she came into some wealth. What was the incentive for this banker, Mr.
Thatcher,
to take away Charles Cain? What was the incentive for that? And somehow he would send her money. He would send Cain's mother money for taking
Cain had
away?
A trust, I guess.
Okay,
from
right.
His money that he would get when he was 25.
Okay. I don't understand how Thatcher ended up there, essentially.
Yeah.
Can you explain briefly? Because I don't know. And I didn't have time to research it before.
Weird. That's an interesting thing about the movie. It's like the first 5 minutes are actually kind of confusing. It ends up not mattering, really, to the rest
of
the film.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, everything's going so fast, and I was able to, you know, I didn't miss a beat, except for in the first, like, couple minutes of the film where you're not quite sure why things have unfolded as they have. But again, I don't think it matters too much.
Probably not.
To
yeah.
how you experience the rest of the movie. And
yeah, I don't think it explains very well what Thatcher is doing there, other than, you know, she just wanted her son to have an education out in the East so he could do something with his fabulous wealth once he got it when he was older. So I don't know if there, it could just be completely arbitrary. You know, she just needed some wealthy person to take charge of her son to teach him about finance, because otherwise he would have really had no future out there.
Right. Yeah. This is the Midwest, I presume.
Yeah.
You're right though, Felicia. I mean, it probably doesn't matter. What does matter are things like, I observe that, like, you're trying to think, like, well, the film doesn't really flesh out this, like, ostensible innocence that he lost. Like, all we see him is playing outside in the snow with snowballs for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, but actually that's kind of key, because it's like he's playing by himself. He doesn't have any friends when he's a child, and he doesn't have any friends in his adult life. It's like a kind of through line throughout the film, that kind of is, it's his entire life. He doesn't have any real friends. And I don't know if that was because he got taken away from home too soon, or if he was maybe to some degree, he was just kind of, that's who he was as a person, you know? Like,
going back to like the quintessential American story, it's just the story of the individual. It's individualism,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe there's something to that.
There's some like Freudian kind of Freudian psychology going on here, though. Like, that's that, like, losing something like that could, like, drive you to be so power hungry and ambitious, and that would be like the primary motivator in your life, yet also be the one thing that you can never live down.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, in a way, the kind of psychology of his character is, I don't know if it does hold up to like modern scrutiny, but on a symbolical kind of level, I think it works really well.
Yeah. That is an interesting point, though, about the kind of lack of explanation of his, like, innocence that he supposedly lost. It is kind of interesting that there is really so little that we see of that.
Mm-hmm.
It, almost like it's another kind of false explanation for this character. And ultimately, there is no explanation for character.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
That could really be the point of the film. And actually, there's a great line from, I believe, Jorge Luis Borges, who wrote a review of Citizen Kane, and he didn't like the film, but he said a lot of really interesting things about it. And one was that it was a labyrinth without a center.
Hmm.
And that's maybe a good way to look at it. For all these explanations, they're like false centers. They're not real. Like, they're not the center of the labyrinth. There is no center. You can't find the core of Kane because there is no core.
But you say that and you keep saying that, yet Rosebud in the film is held up as the answer to his psychological motivations. Is it not?
Well, it's a structuring device more than anything, I think.
Hmm.
It's like the end of the quest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that's the